on her team for 6 years. But we're not the same anymore. Vic got promoted. We stole Sterling from Denver. She put her name in for unit chief 10 months ago.
Shit.
No one ever thought Hanoverian would do it. He's turned it down so many times before. But then he got shot in the chest, and it was his only way to stay in the bureau. She must have been pissed. She doesn't like the way he does things. Never has, you know that. Most of the case 10 months ago had involved Simpkins trying to retrain me and Edison. I've been in the bureau 10 years. Edison's been here 16. We're not NATs. It made the case hell, because she insisted on treating us like we've never learned anything useful under Vic. Edison's promotion and Sterling's transfer came as welcome news, because it meant we were staying a separate team rather than getting folded permanently into Simpkins's. "So what are you going to be doing at CPS?" I ask, not even pretending to reach for a graceful segue. She's got a theory that the killer may be a social worker. I snort in spite of myself. Let me guess. Your theory. That she seemed disinclined to pursue. She's been a great field agent for over 20 years. She wants to move up the ladder while she's still young enough to make a good run of it. I hate politics, I groan. I just want to do my job. I do not want to keep track of who wanted what promotion and who doesn't like who. Well, you'll be able to put warnings in the welcome guide.
Speaking of which...
Hey, what do you want to do for lunch when we're done? She chirps.
Nice try. Why did you give them the NAT guide?
Her sheepish smile is the only admission of guilt I really need. We need something, Mercedes. It's the beginning of July, and we've already had 20 agents either transfer out of CAC or leave the bureau entirely just this year. So why don't you write it? How many times did you have to talk me out of quitting the academy?
Every time we had to fire a gun. That just means you don't like guns. You were fine at everything else.
But a field agent who can't stand guns isn't much use as a field agent, is she? You got me past that. Be as pissed as you want that we didn't tell you the guide was getting passed around. That's fair. But you're the right choice, because no matter how many times you had to talk one of us down or talk one of us up, you never lied. You never said one thing that was untrue. That is what we need for the new hires. They don't need to be babied. They need to be honestly warned. Who's going to do that better than you?
The only reason I don't hate you entirely is because this stupid handbook is the only thing between me and suspension.
I accept gratitude in the form of Marlene Hanoverian's iced cinnamon raisin rolls.
Don't push it.
My phone buzzes with a text from Sterling.
Simpkins is here. Edison needs to talk to you when you get back from lunch.
Problem? Cass asks, passing a car going 15 below with its hazards on for no apparent reason.
If you and Holmes want me checking on the other kids, we'll need to do it while we're here. Once we get back... Edison has to tell me we're hands off.
And him telling you that now doesn't apply?
He didn't tell me that. He had Sterling tell me something around that.
Okay, maybe I'm starting to question the wisdom of having you teach the noobs.
Too late now.
Well then, she hits the gas, pushing us 10, 15, 20 over the limit.
Let's make the most out of lunch.
16.
Manassas Child Protective Services is quiet over the lunch hour. Most of the staff either out for the meal
or eating at their desks so they can keep working on paperwork. The social workers, nurses, and administrators have their own offices, but the center of the largest room is a cluster of half-wall cubicles that stand guard in front of the physical file room. Every digital file has a physical counterpart, just in case, and the clerks are also in charge of putting together duplicate files for law enforcement or the court. There are small, restrained personal touches on the desks, an awareness that for all that this is their working space, it's also a public space, such as it is. "Can I help you?" asks the woman at the closest cubby. She's probably early 20s, with a bright smile and a lanyard covered with the FSU logo. There's a row of fuzzy pastel pencil toppers stuck to the top of her monitor, a cheerful lineup of cats, foxes, puppies, and rubber ducks, with a teddy bear in the middle, and a small, neatly framed cross-stitch that reads, "Life sucks, and then you die. Some days it's hard to tell the difference," in a charming block font with a border of hearts and flowers. She looks familiar in the same way so many of the new agent trainees look familiar. A 20-something's wonder at the world beyond college and the struggle with the lingering freshman 15. It makes me feel old, and I'm still too young for that, damn it. Cass steps forward, given that I'm not really supposed to be here. "I'm Agent Cassandra Kearney with the FBI. What is your name, please?"
"Carolyn," the clerk replies, a dimple deepening in her cheek. "Carolyn Tillerman. How can I help you today, Agent?"
"If I give you a list of case numbers, are you able to give me a list of everyone who's worked on those files?" Carolyn's smile dims, her head tilting to one side. "I can take down your information and give it to one of the admins," she says after a moment. "But I'm pretty sure they'll need a warrant. I mean, I know it's not as sensitive as the files themselves, but I don't think I'm allowed to give that out. Sometimes families can get a little angry, you know?"
"Oh, I know."
"Which admin would you be passing that to?" Cass asks. "Because we have a warrant in the works, and if I can get their information, I can just send the warrant along once the judge signs it. Get a jump start on both sides of it."
"Our direct supervisor here in records is Derek Lee, and he's in his office. I can introduce you?"
"That would be excellent, Carolyn. Thank you."
Carolyn stands and adjusts the heart-shaped locket at her throat with a gesture that looks ingrained, and leads Cass back into the hallway. She throws a curious look at me over her shoulder, but I'm probably going to cause enough trouble just by being here. I don't really need to give a supervisor reason to remember I was here. Instead, I stroll down the aisle that splits the sections of cubbies, taking in the personalizations. Either someone in the office cross-stitches, or they bought them together, because all six desks have a similar frame to Carolyn's, all of them just a little subversive, until the last, tucked away in a corner where visitors are least likely to see it. It raises the bar with its flower-bordered, "Bless this fucking office." It's both charming and disheartening.
"What are you doing back there?"
I turn to the front, keeping to the middle of the aisle, with my hands cupped loosely around my elbows to be non-threatening and show that I'm not holding anything. The woman is probably mid to late 40s, with a severe expression and an ugly corduroy patchwork blazer. Her lanyard is plain black, no buttons or pins.
"Admiring the cross-stitch," I answer simply. "Which one is yours?"
Her eyes flick to the last desk, the one with the most subversive saying.
"No one is allowed behind the walls."
"My apologies." I walk past her, back to my spot near the door.
"I'm an FBI agent. Agent Kearney is back with the administrator and Carolyn." She leans against the sturdy divider between Carolyn's desk and the one behind it.
And you're not back there. Why?
Not my case. Kearney needed to stop in before we got lunch. The woman pulls the blazer closer, tucking her hands deeper into the sleeves. The air conditioning is limping, working not well enough, but she looks genuinely cold in the warm office. She gags suddenly, coughing harshly into one sleeve. Her other hand braces against the divider to keep her upright. I sway closer, but her ferocious glare pins me in place through the rest of her fit. When it's done, she carefully gulps in deep breaths, the blotchy flush slowly receding. Then, the color flares back in full force when she lifts a hand to her hair and realizes she coughed hard enough to set her blonde wig askew. I look away, watching from the corner of my eye as she straightens it with shaking hands. She has the look of someone losing weight, an underlying pallor and skin sagging slightly in unexpected places. It could explain her feeling cold, even in this heat. Can I get you some water? I ask neutrally.
Like water's going to help, she wheezes,
but she does move back to her desk to pick up a tumbler. The name tag on the divider says she's Gloria Hess. My phone buzzes with another text from Sterling. Simpkins is sending a pair of agents to the hospital after lunch. Edison and I are eating with them, so we can tell them what we observed about the kids.
Okay, come on, Cass, we've gotta go.
After a few minutes of silence and Miss Gloria glaring at me from across the room, Carolyn and Cass return. Cass comes to my side, and I hold the phone out so she can see the message. This one doesn't take a great deal of familiarity to decode, and she nods quickly. Crossing to her desk, Carolyn smiles at her coworker.
Gloria, this is Agent Kearney. She's working on the case with those poor kids.
Gloria arches a carefully drawn eyebrow.
Can you think of a case in this office that doesn't include those poor kids?
At Carolyn's blush and stammer, she turns to Cass.
Are you able to tell us which case?
Cass glares at me, and I shrug. The incidents have hit the news, even if the details and their connections have been withheld. And, confidentiality aside, an office is an office. People gossip.
The Wilkins, Carter Wong, Anders, and Jeffers murders.
Both women look startled at the length of the list, and Carolyn pales. Gloria moves up to pat her shoulder.
There was another one? The older woman asks.
At Cass's nod, Gloria looks at me with narrowed eyes.
You're Agent Ramirez, aren't you? The one the children are taken to.
Damn. Yes, I acknowledge, but please don't mention I was here. I'm not actually allowed to work the case, not when it involves me to such an extent. I'm just worried about the kids, so Agent Kearney allowed me to tag along. I rummage up a sheepish smile. Honestly, I was kind of hoping to run into Nancy, maybe get an update.
She's doing visits all day today, Carolyn informs me.
But I can leave a message.
Oh, no, I don't want to get her in trouble, I say quickly. I'm supposed to be hands-off, but the kids.
To my surprise, Gloria seems to thaw a bit at that.
We'll let her know you called, unofficially, if there's been a change. I'm sure she can find a way to let you know.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you. She nods slowly, thoughtfully, like I've given her something new to consider.
Agent Kearney!
A man hurries out from the admin hallway, holding a neon green post-it in his hand. It nearly matches the polish on his fingernails. He's a slender man of average height, with a soft voice.
When you get that warrant signed, this is my direct line, he tells her in a faded Charleston accent. It's the only city I know where rushed and clipped Southern is a thing that happens. Give me a call and we'll get right to work on that list for you.
Cass murmurs a thank you and tucks the note into her credentials.
Mr. Lee, this is Mercedes Ramirez.
Mercedes, this is Derek Lee, the file administrator. He takes one of my hands in both of his.
Isn't this all just awful? How are you holding up?
At the moment, I'm a little distracted by his eyeliner game, being fiercer than mine.
How does he get the wings so even?
I'm okay for now, Mr. Lee. Thank you. Just trying to find out how the kids are doing.
Nancy says they're all being terribly brave.
He squeezes my hand and lets it go.
If you two need anything, I mean just anything, please let us know. We all want those little angels safe, don't we?
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Cass repeats her own thanks and a goodbye, and we head out to the car.
What's on your brain, Mercedes? She murmurs as we're buckling in.
When the warrant clears, see if the filing clerks are listed on the files they work, the way the nurses and social workers are.
Which name should I look for?
Gloria Hess. Any particular reason? If charming personalities were conclusive factors, after all, Edison would have been jailed years ago. Blonde wig and a port in her chest. She's got cancer. You spend your life face to face with the best and worst the system has to offer. What's a thing you want to do once you have nothing left to lose? Cass blinks.
Also, Derek Lee, I add, we haven't definitely ruled out that the killer could be male. Put a wig and loose clothes on Lee, he could easily be mistaken for a woman. So we should check him out as well.
Cass stares at me for a moment, then lowers her forehead to the steering wheel and swears emphatically.
17. We speed to the hospital because there's really no telling how long Sterling and Edison can stall Cass's teammates. I mean, I have a healthy respect for their ability to bullshit and inconvenience. Sterling once managed to make a person of interest not only miss his flight, but willingly leave the airport to give her a ride back to the precinct. It was gorgeous. But Drew Simpkins keeps a pretty tight rein on her team. If she tells them to leave now, it won't matter if they don't have all the information. Cass has only been on Drew's team about a year and a half, and I give it another few months or one more bad case before she goes to Vic and asks to be moved to a different team. She approaches life and investigations more like we do. Oh, God. Cass on our team? Poor Edison. Mason, Amelia, and Sarah are all in the hospital for treatment, but they allowed Ashley and Sammy to stay with their sister rather than move them to a group home or foster family. We stop in with the Carter and Wong trio first. Sammy is fast asleep in Sarah's lap, a stuffed tiger fisted in his hands. The teddy bears the killer gave the children have all been taken into evidence, but they gave them different plushies for comfort. I don't see Ashley in the room. Sarah flinches at first when the door opens, but she smiles when she recognizes me.
Agent Ramirez.
You can call me Mercedes, Sarah. How are you doing? She hesitates, running her fingers through her brother's dark hair. He squirms at the touch, then relaxes into it, drooling a little onto the tiger's bright fabric.
We're okay, she finishes. Okay for now.
Can I introduce you to someone? She looks curiously at Cass and nods. She's met an endless succession of new people in the past 9 days. God, has it really only been 9 days?
so getting asked for permission must be a switch.
This is Agent Cassandra Kearney. Cass, my friend interjects with a cheery wave.
And she's on the FBI team that's officially partnered with the Manassas police to find the woman who killed your mother and stepfather. She's also an old friend of mine and someone I trust.
Cass blushes a little.
We've been friends for 10 years, and there's a lot that's implied by that level of friendship, but I don't think I've ever stated it so explicitly. I'm not sure there's ever been a reason to.
Sarah gives her a shy smile, but it quickly drops into a frown.
So, you're not on our case anymore?
Technically, I never was. I can't be.
Because it's your house?
Right. Cass is part of a team, and I think you're going to meet a couple other members of the team this afternoon, but I wanted to check on you. After this, I might not be allowed.
Sarah looks between me and Cass.
Those are strange rules.
They are, I agree, but they're meant to protect you. Speaking of which, where's Ashley?
A volunteer took her down to the cafeteria. They're getting ice cream. I think they're just getting her out of the room.
Her lip wobbles a little bit, but she takes a sharp breath and squares her shoulders.
She really liked Samuel. He gave her things she wanted.
She's angry.
Really angry. She keeps saying it's my fault.
Her eyes are bright as she looks down at her brother.
Mercedes.
I'm right here, Sarah.
I sit next to her on the bed, one hand on her shoulder.
Nancy doesn't think we're going to be able to find a place for all three of us.
I don't want them to split us up, but Ashley is so angry.
I change the hand to a sideways hug, rocking her gently.
Sounds like Nancy is keeping you in the loop.
She nods against my shoulder.
She says it'll help me. Maybe I don't get a say in what's going on, but at least I'll know about it.
Have you talked to your grandparents?
Once. They're really...
racist?
Yeah.
Settling into a chair near the bed, Cass's eyebrows climb toward her hairline, but she doesn't say anything.
And, like I said, Ashley really liked Samuel. If she had to listen to our grandparents badmouthing him, I think she'd run away. And, well, Sammy...
She sniffs back tears, and it breaks my heart to see her working so hard to look strong. I already know she's strong. I know what she's survived.
What did you do?
Cass shifts in her chair. She knows I've got a personal reason for being in CAC. It's the kind of thing that gets around. But I've never told her what that personal thing is.
I was the only one taken away, I tell Sarah softly, and my extended family was never really an option. It's different for you.
The doctors said I'm clean, Sarah says abruptly. That's like health class stuff, right? Like diseases?
Diseases and making sure you weren't pregnant.
What if I had been? Pregnant, I mean.
It would depend a lot on how far along you were. If it were posing risks to your health, who got custody of you, there's not really one straight path there.
Did they say how you're healing?
I have an infection, but they said it's a really common one. A
UTI. It means urinary tract infection. And yes, it's really common for women for all sorts of reasons. Fortunately, those don't have long-lasting effects, and they're pretty easy to treat.
They won't let me put sugar in the cranberry juice.
Yeah, that's pretty gross, isn't it?
We stay for a little bit longer, but I don't think she's lying when she says she's okay for now.
Ashley isn't back yet when we leave. That may be for the best. If she's as angry as Sarah says, she's probably pissed at me, too.
It's not entirely logical, but anger and grief and trauma so rarely are.
I always forget, says Cass, as we head to Amelia's room.
Forget what?
How honest you are with victims.
Kids, I correct. I'm honest with kids, and I think everybody should be.
No Santa Claus for you?
That's different. Santa Claus isn't asking them to trust him.
We announce ourselves at Amelia's room, and she calls out for us to enter.
She's pacing in front of the long window, one arm up in a sling. I introduce her to Cass, just like I did for Sarah, and ask her how she's doing. She snorts and looks down at the sling.
I don't want to wear this, but they said I have to.
What's wrong?
They said my shoulder's dislocated and, my collarbone is cracked. Said they have been for a while, so they want me to wear this for a few weeks. Let everything heal properly.
Why does the sling bother you?
Amelia, there's no wrong answer here, as long as it's an honest one.
It looks like I'm begging for attention, she admits, slumping down on one end of the bed. Or showing people the easiest way to hurt me.
They found somewhere for you to go, didn't they?
Both she and Cass look startled.
How did you know?
Oh, she continues quickly. Of course they told you.
They haven't, but you wouldn't worry about looking injured as long as you're in a hospital. It's kind of what it's for.
She used to do this in the academy, too,
Cass fake whispers to Amelia, who actually giggles. Running her fingers along the sling strap, Amelia adjusts it away from the small square bandage that covers the cigarette burn.
My dad has a cousin in Chantilly. Were your dad and his cousin close?
Yeah, it's like 20 minutes away, they said.
Cass grins.
I meant, were they friends?
Oh. They'd get together to watch games sometimes, but not really. I've met him, though. Before, too. And he came yesterday to ask me if I'd be okay living with him.
He seems nice. Well, that's a plus, isn't it?
I'll have to change schools, but...
Amelia looks at us and takes a deep breath.
Maybe that's not a bad thing. I mean, no one in Chantilly would know about my parents being murdered, right? They wouldn't know I was bad.
You were not bad.
Cass and I say in unison, that startled look jumping back into Amelia's eyes. I reach out and touch her knee with the back of my hand.
Amelia, I promise you, none of this happened because you were bad.
Your dad lied to you for a very long time, and maybe he lied to himself. Maybe he convinced himself you were bad so he wouldn't feel guilty for hurting you.
But you weren't. I promise you, you weren't.
Lincoln, Dad's cousin, wants me to go to therapy.
I think that could be a big help.
Dad always said therapy was for sickos and wimps.
Your dad was wrong about a lot of things.
She looks like she needs to chew on that thought for a bit, so we say goodbye and remind her she can call Cass for anything she needs, even if it's just to talk. Closing the door, we hear a sharp, "There you are," and flinch. It's not Simpkins, though. It's Nancy, the social worker.
"Sorry," she huffs, jogging down the hall. "Didn't mean to sound pissed off. I just didn't want you to walk away. One of the nurses said you were here."
"Just checking up on the kids," I tell her.
"What would you think about meeting Mason?"
Is he going to be okay with that? Us being female and all?
Keep a good distance from him, and he seems to listen calmly enough. And he started communicating with us a little.
He's talking?
Writing. But to be honest, I consider that amazing. Nancy, have you met Cass Kearney? She's on Agent Simpkins's team. Nancy holds out her hand, and she and Cass shake briskly, exchanging good-to-meet-yous.
Meeson read the note last night, and I think he wants to know who you are, Mercedes. I don't know if meeting him will help or not, but I don't think it will hurt him.
Tate agrees.
Tate is another social worker?
He is. He's been in with Meeson all day.
Nancy leads us down the hall to another room, knocking on the door with a, "Tate, it's Nancy. I've got a couple of agents with me."
"Come on in,"
calls a warm male voice.
"Rule of the room," whispers Nancy as she turns the handle. "No women past the track of the privacy curtain. He seems to do okay with that amount of space."
7-year-old Meeson Jeffers sits on a beanbag on the floor in the far corner of the room. A few feet away, a very tall, lean black man sits on the floor as well, long legs stretched out in front of him. Mason's socked feet rest on Tate's legs, just below the knee. Mason's shoulders hunch when he sees us, fear jumping into his eyes, but otherwise he doesn't move. Just watches us with his hand around what I'd guess is Tate's iPad. He's too thin, almost to the point of sickly, but otherwise he looks physically unharmed. I know that's not the case, especially not with what Cass told me in the car, but even with that visible fear, he's unnervingly calm.
"Meeson, these are the agents Nancy and I were telling you about,"
Tate informs the little boy.
"That's Mercedes Ramirez."
I give Meeson a little nod and a little wave.
"And this is..."
"Cass Kearney," she says, echoing my gestures.
"This is Meeson Jeffers."
Eyeing the curtain tracking in the ceiling, I sit down on the floor against the same wall as Tate, making sure not even a hair is over the line. It puts me about 10 feet away, with Tate in between us.
"You've had a pretty bad morning, huh?"
He nods solemnly.
"This might be a pretty difficult question to answer, but are you doing okay right now?"
He seems to think about that, then shrugs.
"Okay, let's try something easier. As long as we stay over here, are you okay with us being in here with you?"
He frowns a little, then shrugs again.
"Okay. If that changes, Meeson, if you want or need us to leave, just let Tate know, okay? And we'll go. This is your space, and we don't want to make you uncomfortable."
He doesn't look like he knows what to make of that, which isn't as surprising as I'd like it to be. He's never really been allowed to have any idea of what his space should be.
"Do you mind if I ask you some questions? They'll be yes or no, and if you don't know the answer or don't remember, that's perfectly okay."
There are times in this job when I say okay so many times it no longer feels like a real word in my mouth. But Meeson nods, after an uncertain look at Tate, so I settle more comfortably against the wall, crossing my legs tailor fashion and keeping my hands on my knees, palms up and fingers loose, to be as non-threatening as possible.
"Did the person who brought you to the hospital talk to you?"
He nods slowly.
"Was it a lady?"
Another nod.
"Was she wearing a mask over her face?"
His nod is more confident this time.
"This one is important, Meeson. Did she hurt you?"
He shakes his head.
"Did she mention any other kids or families?"
He shakes his head again.
"When you were in the car, did she bring you straight to the hospital?"
He nods.
"That's odd."
Was she as short as Agent Cass?
She's only 5'1", so it's a fair question, however much the discreet kick to my thigh tells me she's unhappy about it. Mason looks her up and down, his eyes sliding over to Nancy, before he finally shakes his head.
How about Miss Nancy, then? Was she as tall as Miss Nancy?
He pulls one hand away from the tablet to wobble it in midair.
How about a thumbs up for taller or a thumbs down for shorter? Can you do that for me, Mason?
He studies Miss Nancy again, who gives him a soft smile and stays precisely where she is. Slowly, uncertainly, he gives a thumbs up.
This is going to be a little bit harder. Thumbs up if she's closer to Miss Nancy's height. Thumbs down if she's closer to my height.
He looks between us for several minutes, then puts his hand back to the iPad and shrugs, his shoulders staying up near his ears. Why the hell did I ask that sitting down?
That's okay, Mason. It's okay if you're not sure. I know there was a lot going on all at once.
He doesn't smile, but his shoulders drop a bit, and his lips twitch in something that's probably as close to a smile as he gets. I want to keep that almost smile. I ask him more open questions, ones that turn into a silly guessing game, like, what's his favorite color, or who's his favorite superhero, and gradually, as my guesses get more and more off the wall, he starts leaning forward in the beanbag, eager to nod or shake his head to each one, and Tate gives me a broad smile. When Mason starts yawning, we say our goodbyes, leaving him with Tate, and follow Nancy out the door.
"Does he have family who can safely take him in?" asks Cass.
Nancy nods and walks with us to the elevators. "His uncles are making arrangements to get here. They're hoping to arrive tonight or tomorrow if they can get things squared away with their bosses. His father's brother and his husband, I believe.
If he's comfortable with the iPad, can you ask Tate to show him different kinds of cars? If we can narrow down the make and model of the car, that would be a big help."
"I'll pass that along." I press the call button for the elevator.
"One of your filing clerks, Gloria," I say casually, aware of Cass stiffening beside me. "Is she always that grumpy?"
But far from suspecting anything, Nancy gives a soft, sad laugh.
"Oh, dear, Gloria. She's having a time of it, I'm afraid."
"She's ill."
"Yes, breast cancer, but it's spread into her lungs and down into her abdomen. She insists on working, though, any day she feels strong enough. I think having something to do helps her a bit emotionally. And, well, this may be something that makes the CPS gossip rounds more than the national news, but did you hear anything about the CPS office in Gwinnett County, down in Georgia?"
Cass and I both shake our heads.
"She grew up just outside of Atlanta, and her sister and brother-in-law both work in that office. She's a nurse, he's a social worker. There was a big scandal there recently, and an investigation uncovered that several of the employees were purposefully concealing some abuse cases, or declining to investigate fully, and they were all cases involving employee kids or the kids of friends."
"Her sister and brother-in-law?"
Nancy nods reluctantly. "So they're off to prison. But the courts wouldn't let Gloria take her nieces and nephews because of the cancer. They said she's not healthy enough to take care of 5 kids. And truthfully, she's not. But the kids got split up between different family members. And then with her husband's sudden death, she's just really had a bad few months. If she offended you..."
"Oh, no, nothing like that. She was snippy, but clearly she has reason to be. I was just wondering if we'd caught her on a bad day,
or if she was just generally a grump. Every office has one, you know.
Lord, yes. Tell you what, though. Give her a name, and she can find the file in under 10 minutes without even having to look it up. She knows the name of every kid who comes through our office. And last year, she got the entire records room reorganized so it actually makes sense now, and got all the digital files tagged and cross-indexed.
How's her prognosis?
Not very good, I'm afraid. She found it late.
We'll pray for her, I say, and Nancy beams. Just maybe don't tell her that.
God bless you both. Off to see Ronnie next?
He's with his grandmother, right?
Yes, she's up in Reston. Let me get her number for you.
We wait to call until we're out of the hospital. Cass's phone has been buzzing intermittently for the last hour, and every voicemail and almost every text is from Simpkins, those that aren't from her teammates, warning her, I assume. I can't make out the words of the second voicemail, but the tone is pissed. Try not to get written up for my sake, I tell her, tapping in the number for Ronnie's grandmother.
What if I get written up for the kids' sakes? She asks. It did them good to see you.
Voicemail. Do I leave a message?
Sure.
You haven't been told otherwise yet. It drove our instructors nuts at the academy. As much as I'm willing to split hairs to achieve something, Cass takes it to subatomic levels.
I clear my throat just before the beep.
This message is for Mrs. Florrie Taylor. Ma'am, this is Agent Mercedes Ramirez with the FBI, and I was hoping to check in on Ronnie, see how he's doing with everything that's happened. I'd be grateful if you could please call me back when it's convenient for you. I leave my number, then Cass's name and number for good measure, and hang up.
All right. Anything else we need to do in Manassas before we face the music?
Holmes and Mignoni won't be on duty yet, will they?
Not for several hours yet.
Then I can't think of anything else.
Lunch?
I'll bet 20. Simpkins complains to Vic that his team is a bad influence on her agents.
I'll take that bet. No way she bitches at the unit chief like that. Not out and out.
18. You won $20 yesterday. You're buying the coffee today. Edison informs me via text while I'm brushing my teeth at his kitchen sink. The fact that he felt the need to send that text from the bathroom is disturbing. He could have just yelled it. It's also a harbinger of how entirely shitty the rest of the day is going to be, because Simpkins spends a good 2 hours raking us over the coals for interfering with her investigation. Vic eventually has to step in, and that's when it gets nasty. Vic rarely yells. He doesn't like giving anyone the satisfaction, but it's been a long time since I've seen him that close to it. Whatever Simpkins's ambitions, though, Vic quite simply outranks her, both in actual position and tenure. He's been an agent with the Bureau for 38 years. He started in the Bureau 2 months before Edison was born. Weirdly enough, though, it's Edison who's the more bothered by that particular fact. Once we're out of Dodge, I get to spend the rest of the morning digging into the hard drives freshly delivered from archives. It's dropped off by one of the baby agents, and even before she gets to my desk, I know where she works. The baby agents assigned to the archives are all immune to the Edison catnip because they're all so terrified of Agent Alcest at first. By the time they realize they don't have to be afraid of Alcest as long as they leave her alone, they've outgrown the catnip vulnerability, for the most part. I hate this.
digging through old cases to see which child might have grown up to be a murderer. Not just the kids we rescued, but their friends and family. The friends and family of the ones we couldn't save. Even in some cases, the children of the ones causing them harm. In a few terrible cases, the kids causing the harm. Reading through the files to assess perceived connections, plugging them into our system to find out where they are now, it's horrific. Kids who face monsters can grow up to be monsters. I know that. And some grow up to chase monsters. I just don't want to think that a child I held and comforted could grow up to do this. It's slow, tedious, heartbreaking work, and far too vivid a reminder that a rescue is a moment, not a state of being. Whatever we saved them from, we were powerless to influence what came next. I know that better than most. This, I think, is exactly why we're trained to let go of cases once they're done. How could we do this job if we're constantly aware that even our successes can lead to terrible things? By the end of the day, everyone is either short-tempered or walking on eggshells in the bullpen. Sterling and I are sitting atop Edison's freakishly organized desk, our feet on his thighs to keep him seated, passing around menus to decide on dinner, when Vic walks up. We all watch him warily. Because there's this thing that Vic sometimes does, where he will absolutely have your back in public, but in private, he will break down in excruciating detail exactly what you did wrong and why you need to never do it again. It's not cruel or hateful. It's not even mean. It's just, he gets so disappointed when he has to do it. Disappointing Vic makes you feel lower than dirt. "Stop that," he chides. "You're not in trouble." "Are you sure?" Sterling asks doubtfully.
"Simpkins was out of line."
"Yes, you probably shouldn't have wiggled around the lines as much as you did, but we got a call from the lead social worker telling us how much it helped the kids to see Mercedes. So, clearly, you did what was needed. Now, none of you are coming in tomorrow."
"We're not?"
"No. We've been over this. When you're on desk rotation, there's this thing called overtime that the Bureau doesn't want to pay you. You're done for the week. Go home. Better yet, go to the train station and pick up the girls, because I have to sit down with the section chief and explain the ruckus today." Gathering up the handful of menus, Edison stacks them neatly and tucks them into the top drawer, gently moving Sterling's legs out of the way to do so.
"All right, we'll take them out." "We were just going to do pizza at the house," Vic tells him.
Edison just shrugs. "I'm not letting them see that apartment until you're there to show it to them, and you know Jenny will automatically lead them to it." Vic gives him a long look, but surrenders without another word.
"I'll let you know when I'm leaving the office, then."
Launching herself off the desk, Sterling nearly skips over to her bag, pulling a slim something in a garbage bag out from behind her filing cabinet. "I was hoping we'd get to pick them up."
"Are you going to show us what that is?" Edison asks, eyeing the bag.
"Not yet." We take Vic's car to the station, leaving Edison's keys with him, as Vix is the only one capable of legally seating at least six people. When we get there, Sterling excuses herself to the restroom while Edison and I figure out where we need to be. It's a bit of a zoo with the commuters hitting the road home. Amtrak is the way Inara and Victoria Bliss prefer to come down. Inara, who never really seems afraid of anything, absolutely hates flying, and has done it all of once. Not once round trip. Once.
She actually canceled the return flight and caught the train. She hated it so much. Priya has never seemed to care, one way or the other, but she's not going to fly down separately from them for a couple $100 more.
Has Ronnie's grandmother called back yet? Edison asks, when we get vaguely where we need to go.
Yes, she told Cass that Simpkins had told her not to answer or return my calls, and she was very confused. I didn't envy Cass having to explain that.
You were allowed to speak to Cass?
When Anderson went to lunch, I borrowed his computer for the inner office chat, so if Simpkins gets twitchy, it looks like Anderson did it.
She'll eat him alive.
I'm okay with that.
It's not just you, right? All the women in the office hate him?
Hate who? Sterling asks suddenly, popping up behind the violently flinching Edison.
Bells, he mutters. I swear to God, Bells.
Anderson, I tell Sterling. Oh. Yes, most of us hate him.
And the others?
He asks, one hand still over his heart. Don't have to interact with him.
Ooh, that's them.
She hands the garbage bag to Edison, tears open the knot, and pulls out a folded poster board sign with huge, glittering green letters that say, Bitches Be Here.
Christ,
sighs Edison, staring at the ceiling, for inspiration or patience. We can tell the exact instant the girls coming down the steps see it, because Victoria Bliss doubles over, cackling, losing her balance, and both Inara and Priya have to grab the back of her shirt to keep her from cracking her head on the stairs.
I love it,
she yells across the terminal, either not noticing or not caring about the glares sent her way from other passengers and families. As soon as they're close enough, it's a tackle of hugs, and even Victoria Bliss punches Edison on the arm. It's basically her version of a hug, if you're male.
Where's Vic?
Asks Priya, looping her arm around Edison's waist and pinching him when he tries to take one of her bags.
Office politics.
She rolls her eyes and pinches Edison again when he makes another try for the bags.
Is he regretting the promotion yet?
Not as much as he would be regretting retiring if he hadn't taken it. Giving up on Priya's duffel, Edison manages to get both Inara's and Victoria Bliss's overnight bags. At which point, Inara reaches out for Priya's duffel, which the other girl willingly surrenders. Edison wilts. There's really no other word for it. He looks like a puppy who doesn't know what it did to get yelled at. Stop pouting, Priya tells him calmly. I made a promise to Keely about some of the pictures in there.
Have I ever gone through something of yours without explicit permission?
You have not, but this was about making a 15-year-old more comfortable with letting me take the pictures. So I promised her that Inara and Victoria Bliss are the only ones, other than me, who'll touch the bag, much less the pictures. He considers that for a moment, then adjusts his grip on the other two bags.
Fine.
It's a cheerful ride to the restaurant, a Mongolian grill at which Priya insists we eat at least once per visit. They tell us about shows they've seen and some of the weirder patrons at the restaurant where Inara and Victoria Bliss have worked for years. Priya shows us a picture of the giant, colorful sticker chart on the back of the door where they mark off different ethnic foods they're trying this summer. And, for some reason, none of them can explain. The stickers are all of professional wrestlers. Once Vic sends us word he's on his way home, we finish up and herd everyone back into the car, still laughing and talking over each other. It's later than I realized, the sky edging into night. Inara is the first to spot the house.
Oh,
He finished repairing the garage, she notes. I catch Sterling's grin in the rearview mirror, but she doesn't turn around to share it with the girls. Edison pulls the car into Vic's usual spot on the driveway, and we spill out, grabbing bags at random to carry in, with the exception of Priya's duffel, which she grabs herself. Vic meets us outside, twirling three key rings on one finger. All three girls pile against him for a hug, and he's laughing as much as any of them. Sterling snaps a picture on her phone.
All right, these are for you, Vic announces, handing each of them a ring with a key. Each key is different, the fun decorated ones you can cut at the hardware store, rather than the boring silver or brass ones that come standard with a lock. The girls look at the keys, at each other, and then back at him. This way.
He leads them onto the new mini sidewalk that curves off from the driveway to the outside of the garage, ending near the back of it at a sturdy door.
Try it.
Vic, Inara says slowly.
Try it.
Her key is bright blue with ladybugs on it, and it slides easily into the lock. She's immediately met with a narrow, fairly long flight of stairs, and the other two follow after her when none of us show signs of moving. Then we race up after them. As we round the corner, there's a bright flash from a camera, which has to mean Jenny and Marlene were already waiting. Over the spring and early summer, the hired crew has been hard at work adding a second story to the garage, the top level fully insulated and wired for electricity. There's a small kitchen, mostly built for snack purposes, a full bathroom, a bedroom with a set of three staggered beds, a cross between triple bunk beds and a stepladder, and the biggest part, a living room with comfortable couches and beanbags and with a TV in one corner.
Welcome home, Vic says simply, as the three girls stare around in wonder.
They drop their bags and tackle him in another hug that sends him toppling back onto a couch. Just before he lands, Priya grabs one of the throw pillows and tucks it behind Vic's back to soften the landing. She grins, bouncing on the seat beside him, and Victoria Bliss laughs and chatters. But Inara, eyes bright, turns her face into his shoulder and holds tight. Slipping between me and Edison, in a move that only startles Edison a little, Sterling puts her arms around our waists.
Today's a good day, she says quietly.
In spite of everything that happened earlier, I have to agree.
Edison doesn't say anything, but he's got the small, soft smile that only comes out for family, and that's better than a cheer.
The next day, Vic drops the girls off at Edison's on his way to work with a stern warning to spend the day relaxing, and Sterling joins us shortly thereafter with breakfast. None of the three girls are especially morning-oriented, and I'm sure they stayed up far too late with the giddiness over the apartment. When they're a little more awake, we cycle through turns in the bedroom to change into swimsuits and head down to the pool. Inara and Victoria Bliss in high-backed one-pieces don't surprise me. However comfortable they've grown with the enormous butterfly wing tattoos that were forced on them, they don't generally choose to have them show in mixed company. Priya walks out in a royal blue bikini and an open baseball shirt. I glance over to Edison, who sighs and bites the inside of his cheek to keep from begging her to put on something more concealing, because while Edison is wonderful at respecting bodily autonomy, Priya is his little sister. I don't know how many brothers are ever comfortable with their little sisters, or sisters in general, I guess, in bikinis.
Then Sterling walks out in a bubblegum pink two-piece with a flirty ruffle along the hips, and Edison's cheeks turn a close shade to matching. As the rest of us settle into deck chairs for some sun, Edison immediately dives into the pool to start laps. He isn't going to say it unless I press, but I suspect